The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Brain Science, the podcast that explores how recent discoveries in neuroscience are unraveling the mystery of how our brains make us human. I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell, and this is episode 144. Today, I will be talking with Dr. Angela Federici from the Max Planck Institute for Cognitive Neuroscience in Leipzig, Germany. Her new book, Language in Our Brain, The Origins of a Uniquely Human Capacity, provides an extensive review of our current knowledge about how the human brain processes language. Although this book will not appeal to the average listener, I'm sure you will enjoy her interview, whatever your background. As always, you will find complete show notes and episode transcripts at brainsciencepodcast.com. You can send me email at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com or submit audio feedback at speakpipe.com/Doc Artemis. I will be back after the interview to review the key ideas and to share a few brief announcements. Welcome to Brain Science. It's an honor to have you on the show today, Angela.
It's an honor for me as well.
Before we start talking about your book, Language in Our Brain, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, sure. It would probably be interesting to know that I have a double background. So I'm a linguist and a psychologist. So I did those two studies independently and after each other, because first I studied linguistics and I thought, in order to really know how the language works, you first have to know about the processes, that is the psychological processes. But then I also got a special training in brain sciences because I was more and more interested to know how the language is represented in our brain.
Right. And when I was reading your preface, I got that feeling that your interest in the brain and the language, it goes back many decades. Would you take us through maybe a few highlights of your career to give my listeners a feel for your firsthand knowledge of this field?
When I first studied linguistics, I got in contact with a person who also worked with brain-damaged people. And so I started to work in a project in a clinic where they saw patients with brain lesions. So I was very surprised that one of the first days I saw a patient and he spoke to me and he was not able to speak sort of the full sentences with all the function words. But he was able to sort of tell me basically his story by using the content words. So what was happening here was that he has basically lost the grammar. And I was so surprised about that I thought, oh, gee, I mean, this must mean that the grammar must be represented in the brain somewhere separately. At those times, however, we were not able to use yet the possibilities that we later had with computer and brain sciences to look where the lesion in the brain was. So this only came years later, but it really catched my first interest.
Great. So your book is intended for students and scientists working in the field. But our goal today is to share these ideas with a broader audience. So I hope you'll bear with me if I ask you questions that are less technical than the ones you might be used to answering. Mm-hmm. Also, I know we can't really do justice to the breadth and depth of your book in 1 hour. So I'm going to sort of try to focus on the core language functions and their brain basis. And then if we have time, we'll try to hit on a few highlights from the other parts of the book. So I want to start with asking you if you would explicitly tell us what your starting assumptions about brain and language are. As you start this book, what are the assumptions?
When I first started to think about language, I certainly was influenced by linguistics, and linguistics has a very fine structure with respect to how they describe language. So you have different aspects, like there is the words, these carry the semantic information. And there is the grammar, that is syntax, this is how we call it. These are the rules according to which the words are put together to make a sentence. And then finally, in order to get the production and the comprehension part ready, you also have to have the phonology, because you have to somehow then speak and understand what has been said. So these are three aspects that I thought in the beginning should be represented separately in the brain. Then there are a number of aspects that one could consider. First, one could consider patients with certain breakdowns. One could look at children who have first the possibility to maybe babble and then later on learn words and only later the syntax. And then you could also look into the brain and see whether different parts of the brain serve processing of syntax, phonology, and semantics.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that at the beginning we didn't have the neuroscientific tools that we have now. So at the beginning, the biggest tool would have been, the main tool you would use besides patient information, would that be electroencephalographic readings, or what we normally call EEGs, or was that the first tool that you had?
I think the patients were first. Then later on, this was then in the late 80s, the first EEG, that is electrophysiological experiments, were done in order to find out whether, again, syntactic errors in a sentence and semantic errors in a sentence would give us a different response of the electrophysiological aspects. But this was not very fine-grained with respect to the localization in the brain. We just could see, yes, there is a difference in how the brain reacts to semantic and syntactic errors, for example, which already gives us a certain hint towards that probably these two aspects are differentially processed in the brain.
Right. And I want to talk about this a little bit, because those of us who don't have any background in linguistics, me being in that category, I have to admit that I came to your book with a certain prejudice against the whole idea that syntax was so important. But you convinced me that that the data is there, that they are separate, and that syntax really does come first. Can you take us through sort of the highlights of how that was determined?
I think it's very interesting. When we think about language intuitively, we all think it's the words, it's the semantics, it's the meaning. And language is a meaning machine. But how sort of the words are brought together in a sentence, that's particularly dependent on the syntactic rules. I mean, you can say, well, drink beer, and that is enough to understand that something is going on with beer drinking. But in order to really make a more complex sentence, I know that he wants to drink beer, and this is why I got the beer at home. Things like that, you first also have to find the relation between the different subparts of the sentence. So how can one show that the syntax is processed automatically, although intuitively we never can grab it really? So what has been done, for example, very early on in the days of looking at syntax was the following. Subjects were reading a sentence, and then there was a syntactic error in the sentence. And later on, the subjects were asked to repeat the sentence. And they would repeat the sentence with all the semantics being correct, but they never reported the error. They corrected the error unattentively, if you want. And then at the same time, one had monitored the eye movements of the person who was reading the sentence. And the eyes, and this is what you could see in the data, the eyes were sort of hanging on this syntactic error. They were fixating the error longer than anything else in the sentence. That is, the eye saw the error, that is, the brain saw the error, but later on, the subject could not even report that there was an error in the sentence, even after asking them.
Right.
So this would mean that you very automatically process the syntactic information in a sentence. You never think about it. You just do it. Another possibility was then using the electrophysiological aspects that you, for example, had subjects listening a sentence, for example, and you had a little syntactic error in there. And then basically the brain responses would show you that there is a syntactic error very early on. You have a peak in the brain wave already after 150 milliseconds. So this all goes very fast. When you do the same thing with a semantic error, you get a little peak around 400 milliseconds. So this also means that syntactic information is processed prior in time to the semantic information. Now, here comes the interesting thing. Now you can tell the subject, well, you read a sentence, and then the sentence has a syntactic and a semantic error. And we tell them that there is a syntactic error, and we just tell them, just ignore the syntactic error and just read it for the meaning, the semantics of it. And nonetheless, when you look at the brain responses after 150 milliseconds after the syntactic error, the brain shows you there is an error.
So it's fast and it's automatic.
Yeah, fast, automatic. And this is, you know, everything that's quite automatic is not anymore intuitively, you cannot grab it. Consider, for example, you learn a second language and a second language has a different grammar than your first language. Then when asked about it, you could certainly give information about the grammar of the second language because it's not automatic yet.
Right. I was just thinking about how that, even if I hadn't read about that later in the book, that the first clue here would be this is part of why learning a second language is so hard. A few years ago, I was trying to learn German and I got stuck once I got to all those different versions of every word. I was like, oh no. I really want to talk about how the differences between languages are clues, but I think I may be getting ahead of myself. So now we have the EEG information that tells us when these things happen, and it really tells you a lot about the pieces. Can we back up one more step in this part to the phonological part?
Phonology.
Yeah, sorry. Because that's even before syntax, right?
Well, phonology, I mean, that has to come in at the moment. We always think that phonology only has to do with auditory information. That's not true because phonology is already an abstract representation. So even when you read a sentence, I mean, you internally create your phonology. That is sort of the abstract sounds of it, for example. I think a good example is when you read a sentence that has a comma, internally, you already make up the prosody of the sentence as if you would have heard it. And we, again, can show this in using the electrophysiological measures because when you see this comma, what it means is in the phonological representation that you have a, well, how to say this simply? You make a break, for example, after a main clause when it comes to subordinate clause. For example, Peter knows that he wanted to go home. And then after knows, you do two things. You make a little pause and you also have a change in the pitch. That is sort of the frequency of your auditory outcome, how you pronounce it. And so the interesting thing is that this is related in the event-related brain potential to what we later on called a closure positive shift. That is a shift in the brain wave that is called closure because it closes the phrase. Peter knows close. Mm-hmm. And then comes the next. Now, interestingly enough, when you read a sentence that has the comma, you see the same, exactly the same brain response as if you would have heard it. That means already that while reading, we make up our internal representation online.
What about a deaf person who's always been deaf and maybe uses sign language?
Well, that's an interesting issue. I mean, we have just done two studies. One study is the following. We have looked into deaf subjects who had learned sign language very early and have compared those to normal hearing subjects. And when you look at the brain structures, including the structures that connect the different brain regions, you see exactly the same for the two groups. That is the deaf signers who have learned their sign language early. They look exactly like those who have been hearing with respect to the language fiber tracts. Now, we also looked into those fiber tracts that connect from the auditory cortex, that is from the speech input, if you want, to the language system. And there we do see differences because those who have been hearing from the beginning on have stronger fiber tracts with respect to speech input and speech output.
Right. Have you gotten a chance to do any work with people with cochlear implants?
also, yes, but maybe we can come to that later.
Back to that, yeah.
Because there is a second interesting study I'm doing together in the moment with people from China who have the possibility to look into late and early signers. That is, they have a group of signers because it's a huge country and not everybody is able to sort of be detected very early with respect to deafness. So they have a group of signers that have learned their sign language only after the age of 6 years. And so what is interesting here, now we have three groups. We have late signers, we have early signers, and we have hearing subjects. And only the late signers look different with respect to the language fiber tracts, the structures that indicate sort of how the different language areas are brought together. So this means you have to have early input, that is, as long as the brain is plastic, and it really doesn't matter for the language representations, whether it's auditory or visual in terms of a sign language, but it has to be a language. I mean, sign language is a real language, right?
Right.
Okay, so now you wanted to talk about cochlear implants.
Yeah, do you know about that?
Yes, I have done a former doctoral student of mine. She is working now in a clinic where we have the possibility to look at those cochlear implant people. And there again, it's interesting to see, have they been implanted early or late? And did they have some kind of other language input early on? So you really have to be very careful because very often there are mixed groups. But if you try to then separate those out with respect to who didn't have a lot of language input early by sign language, but only get the implant late, or those who got some input early, not auditory, but otherwise, and then got the implant. I mean, it's very interesting that the latter group, even though they get the implants late, if they had some contacts with some kind of signing early on, they learn much faster a new word than children that are younger. So there we see an age effect, if you understand what I mean. So it's not only the input. I mean, the input is very important, but if you give the input very early to a child, or if you give the input to a person who already has sort of a semantic world available when you are 14 or 16 years old, you know already about a lot of things in the world, and this is part of the semantic representation you have, then word learning is easier for you than when you don't have that early on.
Do we know whether, you know, you talked about how in the deaf person, the auditory tract was smaller. Does that change when a person gets a cochlear implant, or is it too late for that to change?
No, in the hearing people, the auditory streams were not smaller, but stronger.
Okay.
So you get the input, then the fiber tract gets stronger. If you don't get an input like a deaf person, this connection is smaller. So with the cochlear implants, yes, that is an interesting question. I have to say that we are working on that in the moment, and I think I should be a bit careful because, I mean, the number of subjects that we have where we can control for everything, age and age of implant and so on, is not so that I could make a real statement about that.
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
So for many years, EEG provided a lot of information about what was going on, but we couldn't really tell for sure where these things were happening because EEG is kind of not very well localized.
Yes.
But of course, we have old information. You know, we know about the old ideas of Broca's area and Wernicke's area, but then finally, functional MRI comes on. Could you tell us a little bit about, my audience has heard a lot about fMRI, but could you first talk a little bit about the reason why it's tricky to figure these things out in terms of where? I'm thinking in terms of the lack of temporal resolution in the fMRI.
Yes. So with the EEG, we have sort of the wonderful possibility to look at the brain's reaction millisecond by millisecond. This is not the case with the fMRI. So with fMRI, however, we have the possibility to really identify, I think I should say, not only the brain areas where certain things are happening, but I think more important also of how these areas work together to achieve a certain behavior. So in the first fMRI experiments and the methods we had at the time, we were primarily looking at sort of where in the brain. But these days, I mean, most of the studies include how do these different brain regions that we have identified work together. Now, why is it so difficult to sort of really look at the bits and pieces if one would be interested in bits and pieces? It has to do with the fact that when we speak, for example, now, everything seems to happen at the same time. Phonology, semantic processing, syntactic processing. And if you don't have a good time resolution, the only thing that you can do is systematically vary those different aspects in a sentence. And you have to do this in a very fine-grained manner. Otherwise, you will not be able to really localize a particular aspect. For example, what you can do very nicely in a first round is you take out certain information types. So, for example, you don't present full sentences, but you present what we call Jabberwocky sentences. So in those Jabberwocky sentences, this is like Alice in Wonderland. You take out all the content words, all the words with semantic meaning, and you replace them by pseudo words. By this, you take out all the semantic information and you leave, for example, then the syntactic information and the phonological information. How can we take out then the phonological information, for example? We can filter the sentence and then sort of it sounds like a computer language and you don't have all the prosodic information anymore. So what you have to do is to first identify what are the different aspects you want to look at. And then what you have to do is to have at least two or three or four different conditions where you systematically take out certain types of information in order to then identify which area is then not active anymore because I have taken out this type of information. So what you do is by comparing those different conditions, then by inference, you can say, oh, this region obviously is responsible or supports semantic processes. Usually it's more than one region. And this region, for example, is relevant for syntax processing.
I want to take a few moments to thank everyone who supports Brain Science financially via premium subscription, Patreon, or direct donations. Your support is essential because although this show started as a hobby, since my husband died in 2015, the income from Brain Science has become an important part of my budget. Without your support, I will not be able to devote the necessary time and energy to continuing to create new content. If you'd like to learn more about how you can help, please go to brainsciencepodcast.com/donations. Can you give us an overview of our current state of knowledge of this based on all the work that's been done?
Well, an overview in 2 minutes. Well,
okay, well, I'll give you five.
Well, basically, I think it's very clear. I mean, it's the left hemisphere is dominant and prominently involved in language processing, but the right hemisphere is as well. So let's start with the right hemisphere because this is interesting. The right hemisphere is very active right after birth. And the processes that we now know are represented in the right hemisphere are the processes that have to do with prosody, that is with sentence melody, for example. And if you consider a newborn, I mean, the newborn cannot learn words or syntax yet, but it can sort of listen to the prosody, to the sentence melody, to what makes a Russian language versus a French language, for example. So it's the intonation of how you speak. And this then also triggers your right hemisphere when listening. So in the left hemisphere, basically, this is the hemisphere that is responsible for a lot of things, basically, processing the phonetic information of particular phonemes, that is particular sounds that make up, say, a letter. And it then, as we discussed, has to look for the syntactic information, that is all the function words that are around, and then also has to access the semantic information of the nouns, the adjectives, and the verbs that you use in a sentence. So these are basically the information holders of the semantic information, that is noun, adjective, and the verb. And then when you consider this, what you can see is basically that a subpart of Broca's area in the inferior frontal gyrus is mainly dealing with syntactic information. And this is the posterior part of Broca's area. Interestingly, this varies a bit from language to language. In a language that has a heavy morphosyntax, is all those pieces on the verbs and the nouns that indicate its first or second or third person, it's plural or singular, or in some languages where you have a lot of case information, the case information. Those languages that have a heavy morphosyntax process the syntactic information exclusively in the posterior part of Broca's area, which is Brodmann area 44. Other languages that where also semantics gets involved in structuring the sentence also activates the more anterior part of Broca's area, that is Brodmann area 45. They are next to each other and they also talk to each other. That's going on in the inferior frontal cortex. Then the second large piece is what one could broadly call Wernicke's area, but this is basically a huge area in the temporal cortex. We now know that there are also subparts in the temporal cortex. It's the middle temporal gyrus that is more involved in semantic processing, and the superior temporal gyrus is more involved sort of in also syntactic aspects, or I should say in bringing the semantic and the syntactic information together. So in the posterior temporal cortex, basically those informations are integrated. And now you ask, you know, then the question, how comes the information from the inferior frontal cortex and the temporal cortex together? And here, there is this huge fiber track, white matter fiber track, that directly connects Broca's area to the posterior temporal cortex dorsally. And then you have another fiber track that connects basically those areas that are mainly involved in semantics, that is Brodmann area 45 and the middle temporal gyrus. That's the ventral fiber track. So we have two streams. One is sort of running on the upper part and one is running on the lower part in the left hemisphere. And they connect those areas that we have identified to do the syntactic and the semantic processes.
That's a great overview. Thank you. I know that was a hard thing to try to condense down. I want to talk a little bit more about the syntax issue because that's the thing least familiar to most of us. You describe a lot of experiments in your book that have to do with artificial grammars.
Mm-hmm.
Could you sort of explain what that is and why it's such a useful tool?
Well, artificial grammar is one possibility to look at syntax in its purest form because there is no semantics. So artificial grammar, and there we have to be careful in not mixing them up. There are two types of artificial grammars. There's one type of artificial grammar where syllables are brought together according to certain very simple rules. On those rules are rules that are not comparable to rules of a natural language. We have another group of artificial grammars that do the following. They also take out the semantic information. They also deal with syllables, but the syllables belong to certain word categories. Some syllables represent verbs, some other syllables represent nouns, and there are also function word syllables in there. And so they can make up for a real language, although the language doesn't exist. But it's according to the rules that a possible natural language could have. So now the interesting thing is that the first type of grammar, the simple rules where I could say, well, element A and element C sort of, you know, go together, and the element B in the middle can vary. So as long as A and C go together, it's sort of a correct sequence. So interestingly, infants very early on can learn those sequences and show us in the moment when they have learned a certain sequence and they get another sequence where this rule is violated, then the brain shows us a certain reaction. Now, these infants, I mean, they have not established yet the language system. but they have the auditory system and they can obviously detect regularities in the auditory input. This is how infants start also to learn a real language. But obviously something else must then later on happen. So why am I saying this? Because what we have done, for example, we have presented those sequences that are rule-based also to macaque monkeys. And interestingly enough, those can learn those sequences as well and can also detect errors. But the simple sequences they can learn, but they can, so far we have no evidence that they can learn the more complex sequences, not to speak about language. They cannot learn language. I mean, there have been a lot of attempts to sort of train chimps, for example, to learn language. What they can learn is words, but they cannot combine those words to longer sequences. So this seems to be particular for human beings to combine words in a syntactic structure. And so this very nicely shows that we are on an evolutionary trip. We are not very far off from those other non-human primates. But however, there is a certain sort of particular difference. And the difference that could be identified as the difference probably has to do with building hierarchical structures like in grammar.
And do we have a particular parts of the brain that seem to be associated with that ability?
Well, in the moment, our hypothesis, and we have, I think, decent data to support this, it's not the brain area itself when you process syntax, but it's the fiber track, the dorsal fiber track connecting posterior Broca's area to the posterior temporal cortex. Why do we say this? Well, I mean, we have shown, for example, that this fiber track is not yet myelinated in the infant brain right after birth. We don't see it as a white matter, if you want, because the white is the myelin. And then later on, this develops very slowly. And we have shown that from age 3 to age 10, we can predict on the basis of the strengths of the myelin, the goodness of processing syntactically complex sentences. So the stronger the fiber track is, the better you process the syntax. And this is a very significant correlation that we have there. Also, there is some patient studies showing that once this fiber track degenerates, you cannot process syntactically complex sentences anymore.
Great. Could you talk a little bit more about the developmental stages of language in the human brain?
Yeah. There's a lot of things to say about development and also development of language in particular. But I mean, we all know that the child is developing and by this also develops language. So it's only in those rare cases where you have deprived children that we can really separate this. And fortunately, we don't have those children too often. But anyhow, so what we know from normal development is the following. When you look into the entire literature, what we can see is that a lot of processes in the beginning are bottom-up. That is, you hear, you try to detect irregularities in the input, you try to make sense out of it. So all of this is mainly done within the temporal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex, this is also where syntax is later on located, matures much later. And this is very interesting because this anterior part of the frontal cortex is also involved in controlling processes. So the more controlled our entire behavior gets, the more involvement we see from the frontal cortex. The temporal cortex is mainly doing the processes on a more associative manner. For example, see an object and I hear a word, and as long as that comes into a certain time relation that is very closely, then I make the association between this object and the word, and I have done word learning, right? So a lot of those things can be done by the temporal cortex and are done by the temporal cortex. So we have a general model. It's a model only, but compatible with the data that are out there for the moment, is that until the age of 3, that is during the first 3 years, a lot of the processes in language development are supported by the temporal areas. And only very slowly then inferior frontal gyrus and prefrontal cortex come in. And that then also means that now we are in the position to deal with syntactically complex sentences. And not only that, but also other complex things we have to do in order to get through the world.
I was really fascinated by the timing of when you have to learn language or be exposed to language before the age of 3 to be able to have normal syntax abilities, because those are automatic, but you have to learn them really early, even when you don't know you're learning them. I guess, I don't know if that sounds sensible.
Well, I think what you learn early is that you identify the dependencies of regularities in the input. For example, in English, when you have he is running or he was running, is and was really requires that you have the ing at the end of the verb. And those relations, which are syntactic in the end, are learned very early on by association.
Oh, okay.
By auditory association between those elements. Later on, you then realize the syntactic gist of it. But first, you can learn it basically on association. Why am I saying this? Because we have done the following. We have had 4 months old infants, and I wanted to use an artificial grammar, but then we discussed it in our group and people said, well, you know, maybe later on they say, oh, it's only artificial grammar. So why don't we take a real grammar? So I said, well, our German infants coming from German families, we make them learn Italian. So in Italian, very similar to English, you have requirements, syntactic requirements between a particular element that stands, you know, gives you the mode, for example, and the ing, if you want. So you have something like può cantare. So può means can, I can sing. But then you also have something like in English where you have the ing in the end. So sta, and then you have the ing, that's ando. And so what the children had to learn in the sentences, we presented them 36 different sentences. And the only things that were always in a certain relation were those elements before the verb and the verb ending. And we had two types of those. So, può, are, sta, ando. And the interesting thing is within 20 minutes, our German children learned this relationship. And so we had used 36 different verbs. So they couldn't learn it on the verb. They had to learn the relationship before and after the verb.
Right.
Using something like that, you can show that they can learn the phonological dependency between two elements. And those are really elements that are syntactically relevant. So this is why we think you can already do a lot of the first steps with the temporal cortex, with what you have there. And then only later on, you have to involve other systems to process then more complex constructions.
Well, we're just about out of time. And as I feared, we've just barely scratched the surface of your fascinating book and career. Is there anything that you really want to share that I have failed to ask you?
I think you read quite well what's in the book, and I think we have discussed the major aspects of it. I think what really remains open probably also for a lot of the hearers that will listen to the broadcast is probably second language learning. So second language learning is an interesting issue. But maybe what I would like to say also, we have discussed now aspects of how the brain is structured, and we also try to make up for a general model. And the general model I was describing certainly holds, but there is modulation, I think, by the particular languages that we speak lifelong. Why am I saying this? We have interesting data where we have looked into sort of the structure of a German brain, the structure of an English brain, and the structure of a Chinese brain. Why did we do that? Because it was always discussed that those languages are very different. And it was kind of interesting to see that the structures that connect the 2 or 3 or 4 brain areas that are of interest really are modulated by the language use. So, for example, the German that has this very heavy morphosyntax, you know, has a very strong dorsal fiber tract. The English that does not have this strong morphosyntax rather has a strong ventral fiber tract. And the Chinese language that has those prosodic informations coming in as a tonal language has very strong connections between the left and the right hemisphere, which are stronger than in the other language brains. So what we see there is a universal network, but what we can also see is that it's modulated by the different languages that we speak. And I think this could help also to solve a lot of variability that we see in the reports from the different papers out there in the literature. I think it could show that there is a coherence. We just have to look very carefully in what language are we looking at.
Right. I always ask my guests if they have advice for students.
I think the only thing that I can say, you have to be on fire for a certain issue. If you are not on fire yet, look for something that really interests you so much that you easily work day and night on this issue.
That is very succinct, and I think that my listeners will appreciate that. When I started this show, I didn't realize how many students would be listening, but over the years, I've learned that there's students of all different levels. And that's one of the reasons why I like to do books like yours, because for those students, maybe they've never even heard about any of these ideas, and I hope that their curiosity will be stimulated.
Oh, that would be great.
Thanks a lot for taking the time to talk with me. I know you're very busy.
Thanks a lot for your questions. I think you really got something out of the book already.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thanks.
Over the years, neuroscientists have discovered that other animals have many abilities that were once thought to be unique to humans. One well-known example is the fact that chimpanzees and even some birds have the ability to use tools. However, after extensive attempts to teach language to a wide variety of animals, most scientists now agree that although all animals communicate in some way and some can learn human words, language, in its truest sense, appears to be unique to humans. What I mean by language, in its truest sense, is having the ability to form complex hierarchical sentences such as, "The boy gave the girl the book so that she could read it." This distinction is important to researchers like today's guest, Dr. Angela Friederici, whose new book, Language in Our Brain, The Origins of a Uniquely Human Capacity, provides an extensive review of several decades of research. Language in the Brain is a fairly technical book aimed at students and scientists in the field, but it is also appropriate for any serious reader who wants a grasp of the current neuroscience of language. Needless to say, much of the research in this area is partially driven by linguistic theory, which describes language in terms of three key components: phonology, or sound, semantics, or meaning, and syntax, or grammar. Meanwhile, from a neuroscience point of view, two key areas or questions are neuroanatomy and how are the important language-related parts of the brain connected. Evolution of these connections and parts are also of interest. These questions are addressed with somewhat different tools. EEG and evoked potentials provide valuable information about timing. As Dr. Friederici noted, this is how we know that both phonology and syntax are processed very early on, before semantics, even though this goes against the intuition of most non-linguists. Dr. Friederici introduced us to some of the experimental methods that are used to tease out these features. One key idea is that the posterior part of Broca's area, which is also called Brodmann's Area 44, seems to be particularly involved with complex syntax. Of course, this discovery required very sophisticated use of functional MRI data because the functional MRI does not have the temporal resolution needed to isolate anything that's happening in the range of milliseconds. With regards to the use of fMRI data, Dr. Friederici also emphasized that now most research is focused on how the so-called language areas communicate with each other. In fact, this seems to be the key difference between the brains of people who speak different types of languages. She pointed out that German speakers appear to have strong dorsal pathways, English speakers appear to have strong ventral pathways, and Chinese speakers have more extensive connections between the right and left hemisphere. We didn't have time to discuss the chapters that consider the neuroanatomical differences between humans and other primates, but as you might expect, Brodmann's Area 44 appears to be very important. As I mentioned earlier, this book is unlikely to appeal to the average listener. So you may wonder, well, what are the key take-home ideas? First, I want to point out that most of this information was not available the last time I talked about language way back in episode 31. At that time, I was convinced that few linguists were paying attention to the actual neuroscience. But this was obviously not true for Dr. Friederici, who has been a leading researcher in this field for decades. Based on the science in this book, I think it's fair to conclude that speech comprehension involves the three components of standard linguistic theory, phonology, semantics, and syntax, and that there is overwhelming evidence that syntax happens very early and automatically. Also, by combining the temporal resolution of the EEG and the spatial resolution of newer imaging methods, scientists have a fairly good idea of what parts of the brain are important to language comprehension. Areas traditionally associated with language, Broca's area and Wernicke's, contain significant subdivisions. Meanwhile, the study of language in the brain has followed the trend of moving toward an emphasis on connectivity. One thing we didn't talk about much was semantics, but in her book, Dr. Friederici gives this area its due. There are several challenges to trying to determine what areas of the brain are dedicated to semantics, because so many areas are actually involved. Also, there appears to be much more variability between people with semantics than for syntax, since each of us has a unique set of associations for every word meaning that we learn. Another topic we neglected was the importance of integrating semantics and syntax. This appears to involve the association areas of the temporal cortex, but there seem to be quite a few different interpretations of the current evidence in this area. One surprising point she made was that semantic theory is relatively undeveloped. This obviously has implications for experimental design, since most experiments are inevitably influenced by the theoretical expectations of their designers. Dr. Friederici also advised aspiring scientists to find an area that sets you on fire so that you will be motivated to work on it day and night. Her passion for language in the brain came through during our interview and also in the pages of her book. As always, you will find detailed show notes and episode transcripts on our website at brainsciencepodcast.com. I'd love to hear your feedback about this episode, so you can write to me at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com or submit audio feedback via SpeakPipe using the address speakpipe.com/DocArtemis, or if you're using the SpeakPipe app, you need to look for Doc Artemis rather than Brain Science Podcast. If you're listening to this episode before July 5th, 2018, you can submit questions or comments for me to use during the Facebook Live session that will be devoted to this episode that is scheduled for July 5th. In terms of closing announcements, the main thing I want to talk about is our new monthly Facebook Live session, which is the first Thursday of every month at 8 p.m. Central Time. This is your opportunity to share your comments and questions, either live or by sending them in to me at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. Our first session was earlier this month, and I have to admit that we got off to a rough start. Some people had trouble accessing the video, and for some reason I could not see any live comments or questions. I'm working on getting the bugs out of the system. But the main thing you need to know is that each month we will be focusing on the episode that was aired 3 months earlier. This means this episode will be discussed in the July 5th Facebook Live, which means if you're listening before that date, you can submit questions or comments. Today's episode is going to go live on the fourth Friday of April 2018. The May Facebook Live will focus on episode 142, which was a discussion of peripersonal neurons with Michael Graziano. Then in June, we will talk about Elkanon Goldberg's discussion of creativity. If you are a premium subscriber, you will find the audio for each month's Facebook Live in your feed, hopefully around the second Friday of the month. This audio will also be available to Patreon supporters. The original video will remain on our Facebook fan page and on YouTube. If there's anyone who actually wants to see the video in their premium feed, please let me know at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. For now, my goal really is to keep this content audio friendly so that you'll be, if you're a premium subscriber, able to listen to the Facebook Live session as if it was an extra episode. In terms of other announcements, I do need to mention again my hoped for trip to Australia, which is currently being planned for late May or early June of 2019, although I haven't posted details yet. I'm trying to get a group of listeners together, and it's first come, first serve. So if you're interested, please send me email at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com. Before I close, I want to thank all of those of you who support my work, either as premium subscribers, Patreon supporters, or by direct donations. You can learn more about how to support my work at brainsciencepodcast.com/donations. Of course, even if you can't afford to support the show financially, you can help by sharing the show with others. We don't advertise, so word of mouth is very important. Thanks again for listening. I look forward to talking with you again very soon. Brain Science with Dr. Ginger Campbell is copyright 2018 to Virginia Campbell, MD. You can copy this show to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com.